Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dorothy Gundy and Phil Dierking. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, American writer and photographer Michael Beninov has traveled around the world studying the cultures of nomadic people. His work has taken him to places from Mali to Jordan to Mongolia. Beninov writes about people who are threatened, endangered, or chased from their land. Recently, he joined a nomadic tribe in northern India called the Vangujar as they moved across the country. He said that he was surprised by how open and welcoming the group was to him.
They really invited me and welcomed me into their world and really was taken into the family with an incredible amount of warmth and trust.
Beninov noticed how the tribesmen cared for their herd of water buffalo. He found they consider the animals family members and would never kill them for food. Instead, they keep the animals for the milk they produce.
Every Vangujar buffalo has a name. Every buffalo, they say, has a unique personality. If a buffalo was to get sick, the family would be really racked with concern. And if a buffalo dies, they'll bury it and mourn for it, almost as if it was human.
Beninov followed the tribe as they moved with the seasons over 44 days.
In the fall and the winter, they live in an area called the Shivalik Hills.
They are a group of hills in northern India with a forest that provides enough food for the buffalo. By April, however, the area becomes very hot and the food is mostly gone, so they move to the cooler Himalaya Mountains. There, Beninov said, the Vangujar find food and water for their buffalo all summer. But India has begun turning some of its best lands into national parks, pushing out the Vangujar.
Some of them have already been forcibly evicted from the forests where they and their ancestors have lived for over 1,000 years.
The photographer also noted that the people he studied had a deep or profound connection to their environment.
There's a really profound kind of a relationship with the natural world. Maybe some of that comes from the fact that they're living really in intimate contact with the natural world, but also their perspective on it as something that is essentially sacred.
The Vangujar are Muslims. Beninov said he found them to be among the more open communities within India, especially the women. He says he experienced no barriers and he could spend time with the women in the family. Beninov says his experiences have made him understand the differences in the many cultures around the world. He noted, "As the world becomes a more homogenized place, I think it's really important to be remembering all of the different possible ways that it is to be human." Beninov has written about his time with the Vangujar in his latest book, Himalaya Bound. He says he hopes it will expand the world of his readers.
There is no end to demand for Italy's white gold. For many people, that white gold is not metal, but marble from the town of Carrara in Tuscany. The marble mining work in Carrara is ancient. Workers first began removing stone from the mountains of Tuscany more than 2,000 years ago. The ancient Romans were the first to recognize the beauty of the marble. Millions of people still go to Rome to see famous monuments made with the stone. Two examples are the Pantheon and Trajan's Column. And then there are famous statues like the David and the Pietà by the sculptor and painter Michelangelo. So what is happening in Carrara today? Sculptors, other artists, and designers of buildings have never stopped making trips to the Tuscan town. M.J. Anderson, an American, first visited Carrara 36 years ago when she started creating sculptures. She loved the look of the beautiful stone. Anderson says she likes to take things apart. The great thing about carving marble is that once that stone is gone, it's gone. You can't lament about it, and this keeps you moving forward in the creative process, she said. Sculptors like Anderson know they are dealing with something very special.
There's no surprises when you're carving it. The molecules are put together very well, and there's so many different kinds of marble here. That's what's so special.
That is what is bringing in orders and big money from all over the world. Carrara's marble is in great demand in the Arab world and in countries like China, India, and Thailand. Buyers want the material to use in the rooms and floors of their homes. Others want art made of the stone. For example, a few years ago, a request came for a huge block of marble to be used in a massive statue of Buddha. An increase in the building of mosques and Islamic centers, especially in the Arab world, has meant even more demand and big business for some marble companies. The Saudi Bin Laden Group, one of the world's largest builders, got control of 50% of Marmi Carrara in recent years. Marmi Carrara owns a third of the marble quarries that are operational in the area today. Just the name Carrara basically says it's the world's best marble. It is the most beautiful. It has a centuries-long history of being the best marble in the world, and people come here looking for and wanting the very best, Anderson said. What is new is that the demand is moving away from the traditional markets. Anderson noted that for a long time, Italy's white gold has been shipped to American buyers. Now, she said, the buyers are from the Middle East, and they are the ones taking the marble. Ever since the days of ancient Rome, the stone has been shipped to other areas. The great marble artists have historically been Italian, but now they come from all over the world, and some have settled in Carrara. Students like 19-year-old Shitong Zhao come to learn and take their knowledge home. He said his love of art, painting, and sculpture brought him here from China. And he set his sights on studying at the Academy of Fine Arts in Carrara. Working on the marble may be a labor of love, but it is no easy work, Jean noted. Learning to carve the marble is not the only difficulty. Removing the stone from the mountains has been a problem for hundreds of years. Modern technology has made it easier. The marble industry employs thousands of people. For those who labor inside the mountains, it is sometimes dangerous work. The marble mining is also affecting the countryside. Environmentalists have been expressing concerns for years that the industry is destroying the mountains and affecting the appearance of the Apuan Alps. From far away, they appeared to be covered in snow, but in reality, it is the bright marble that makes the Apuan Alps white all year round. It's beautiful to see the quarries. They're fabulous, the way the light hits these walls of marble, said Anderson. Admittedly, she notes, the environmentalists are right to be concerned. Of course, marble does not regrow. It's not sustainable. It was made billions of years ago. Marble is being taken out of here so fast that entire mountaintops are disappearing, she said. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
The non-governmental environmental group, Greenpeace, reports that plastic and chemical pollution is often found in snow and seawater collected by researchers in Antarctica. Greenpeace said its scientists gathered water and snow samples from Antarctica during a visit between January to March of this year. Laboratory tests confirmed the effect of humanity on the continent. It was about one microplastic piece, at least, per liter. When you think of extrapolating that out to the scale or the Antarctic Ocean, it's really, really significant, said Greenpeace's Louisa Kasson. She noted that in the past, scientists thought the currents around the Antarctic Ocean might protect it from plastic pollution found in much of the world's oceans. But now, she said, evidence is increasingly showing that there might be little, if any, protection. Microplastics are extremely small particles of plastic. They come from the breakdown of bottles and other plastic waste in the world's oceans. In addition to microplastics, the Greenpeace study also confirmed the presence of chemicals known as per- and polyfluorinated alkylated substances. These chemicals are widely used in industrial processes and have been linked to reproductive and developmental problems for wildlife. This just strengthens the rationale for why we need to be taking action on land to stop that flow of plastic into the ocean, but also creating huge ocean sanctuaries at sea to allow wildlife to recover from these pressures, Kasson said. The United Nations estimates that 8 million tons of plastic are dropped into the oceans every year. Plastic has been shown to harm wildlife. An example of this happened several days ago in southern Thailand. That was when a pilot whale died after swallowing 80 pieces of plastic waste. Tests showed the waste weighed about 8 kilograms. International concern about plastic pollution is rising. In India, Prime Minister Narendra Modi recently promised to ban all single-use plastic by 2022. In the city of Mumbai, Bollywood movie stars have been taking part in waste cleanup activities at Versova Beach. Actress Abigail Pandey told reporters she was surprised at the amount of waste she found. "I am having fun cleaning this place, but it is also very sad because once I came here, I got to know the amount of waste is so high that if you dig the ground 4 feet, you will still find plastic inside, and it will take years to properly clean the beach," Pandey said. Plastic has now been found in every corner of the world's oceans, from the bottom of the Pacific Mariana Trench to Antarctica. In October, world governments will decide on a European Union proposal to create an Antarctic ocean sanctuary. At 1.8 million square kilometers, the sanctuary would be the largest protected area on Earth. I'm Phil Dierking.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The 1920s are remembered as a quiet period in American foreign policy. The nation was at peace. Americans elected 3 Republican presidents in a row: Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. These conservatives in the White House were generally more interested in economic growth at home than in relations with other countries. But the United States had become a world power. It was tied to other countries by trade, politics, and shared interests. And America had gained new economic strength. Bob Doty and Shirley Griffith discuss American foreign policy during the 1920s.
Before World War I, foreigners invested more money in the United States than Americans invested in other countries, about $3 billion more. The war changed this. By 1919, Americans had almost $3 billion more invested in other countries than foreign citizens had invested in the United States. American foreign investments continued to increase greatly during the 1920s. Increased foreign investment was not the only sign of growing American economic power. By the end of World War I, the United States produced more goods and services than any other nation, both in total and per person. Americans had more steel, food, cloth, and coal than even the richest foreign nations. By 1920, the United States' national income was greater than the combined incomes of Britain, France, Germany, Japan, Canada, and 17 smaller countries. Quite simply, the United States had become the world's greatest economic power.
America's economic strength influenced its policies toward Europe during the 1920s. In fact, one of the most important issues of this period was the economic aid the United States had provided European nations during World War I. Americans lent the Allied countries $7 billion during the war. Shortly after the war, they lent another $3 billion. The Allies borrowed most of the money for military equipment and food and other needs of their people. The Allied nations suffered far greater losses of property and population than the United States during the war. And when peace came, they called on the United States to cancel the loans America had made. France, Britain, and the other Allied nations said the United States should not expect them to repay the loans.
The United States refused to cancel the debts. President Coolidge spoke for most Americans when he said simply, "They borrowed the money." He believed the European powers should pay back the war loans, even though their economies had suffered terribly during the fighting. However, the European nations had little money to pay their loans. France tried to get the money by demanding payments from Germany for having started the war. When Germany was unable to pay, France and Belgium occupied Germany's Ruhr Valley. As a result, German miners in the area reduced coal production. And France and Germany moved toward an economic crisis and possible new armed conflict.
An international group intervened and negotiated a settlement to the crisis. The group provided a system to save Germany's currency and protect international debts. American bankers agreed to lend money to Germany to pay its war debts to the Allies. And the Allies used the money to pay their debts to the United States.
Some Americans with international interests criticized President Coolidge and other conservative leaders for not reducing or canceling Europe's debts. They said the debts and the new payment plan put foolish pressure on the weak European economies. They said this made the German currency especially weak, and they warned that a weak economy would lead to serious social problems in Germany and other countries. However, most Americans did not understand the serious effect that international economic policies could have on the future of world peace. They believed that it was wrong for the Europeans, or anyone, to borrow money and then refuse to pay it back.
Many Americans of the 1920s also failed to recognize that a strong national military force would become increasingly important in the coming years. President Coolidge requested very limited military spending from the Congress. And many conservative military leaders refused to spend much money on such new kinds of equipment as submarines and airplanes. Some Americans did understand that the United States was now a world power and needed a strong and modern fighting force. One general, Billy Mitchell, publicly criticized the military leadership for not building new weapons. But most Americans were not interested. Many Americans continued to oppose arms spending until the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in Hawaii in 1941.
American policy toward the League of Nations did not change much in the 1920s. In 1919, the Senate denied President Wilson's plea for the United States to join the new League of Nations. The United States, however, became involved unofficially in a number of League activities. But it continued to refuse to become a full member. And in 1930, the Senate rejected a proposal for the United States to join the World Court. The United States also continued in the 1920s to refuse to recognize the communist government in Moscow. However, trade between the Soviet Union and the United States increased greatly during this period. And such large American companies as General Electric, DuPont, and RCA provided technical assistance to the new Soviet government.
The Coolidge administration was involved actively in events in Latin America. Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes helped several Latin American countries to settle border disputes peacefully. In Central America, President Coolidge ordered American Marines into Nicaragua when President Adolfo Diaz faced a revolt from opposition groups. The United States gave its support to more conservative groups in Nicaragua, and it helped arrange a national election in 1928. American troops stayed in Nicaragua until 1933. However, American troops withdrew from the Dominican Republic during this period. And Secretary of State Hughes worked to give new life to the Pan-American Union.
Relations with Mexico became worse during the 1920s. In 1925, Mexican President Plutarco Elias Calles called for laws to give Mexico more control over its minerals and natural wealth. American oil companies resisted the proposed changes. They accused Calles of communism, and some American business and church leaders called for armed American intervention. However, the American Senate voted to try to settle the conflict peacefully. And American diplomat Dwight Morrow helped negotiate a successful new agreement.
These American actions in Nicaragua and Mexico showed that the United States still felt that it had special security interests south of its border. But its peaceful settlement of the Mexican crisis and support of elections in Nicaragua showed that it was willing to deal with disputes peacefully. America's policies in Latin America during the 1920s were in some ways similar to its policies elsewhere. It was a time of change, of movement, from one period to another. Many Americans were hoping to follow the traditional foreign policies of the past. They sought to remain separate from world conflict.
The United States, however, could no longer remain apart from world events. This would become clear in the coming years. Europe would face fascism and war. The Soviet Union would grow more powerful. And Latin America would become more independent. The United States was a world power, but it was still learning in the 1920s about the leadership and responsibility that is part of such power.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.